to the International House of Horrors.
Hello, valued guests, and welcome back to the International House of Horrors podcast, your sanctuary of spooky for all things terrible, horrible, brutal, bloody, gory, and the macabre. I am one of your curators here at the house, Joe Merle.
And I'm not hungover for once.
Yay! I'm Josh. Hi. Josh is chipper. He is ready to go. He's a spring chicken yes. Right now. He is, not hungover, which is good. Exactly. Even though hungover Josh is pretty funny trying to remember things like The Exorcist and movies that we all know he knows.
Like movies that everyone knows and I can't think of the name. That's not gonna happen. That's probably gonna happen today anyway.
That's all right. That's good. So it's good to have you back sober and having a good time. But you know what? Go out there, have some drinks, have a good time with life. So, as long as you're not hurting anybody along the way, there's nothing wrong with that. But
I do my best not to.
Yes, we got some cool stuff to talk about today. Some exciting things, but we're gonna kick the show off like we do. I guess not like every week, but as we've been doing for the past 7 weeks. This is the eighth episode, I believe.
Yes, exactly.
Is what we are on. So we're gonna start with the Twilight Zone, season 1, episode 8. One that I was very excited about, and this one premiered over here in the States on the 20th of November, 1959. So this was right around Thanksgiving.
In Germany, it released on the 19th of November, 1991.
Which is so weird that you guys got the Twilight Zone for the first time in the 90s. And even, I mean, if you think about it, I don't know when the first time it was put on, you know, any sort of VHS or any medium or any form of media to actually watch it. Like, even if you ordered it from out of the country, like, was that really the first time people had access to it? Or were there German channels in the 90s that played American or English-speaking shows? Like, do you guys have the equivalent of our, like, I guess BBC is the best way I can think of it? Because when I was a kid, we didn't have, I don't think there was BBC America, but they still showed BBC, so you'd get Fawlty Towers and stuff like that. So I don't know if you guys had anything that was the equivalent of that.
Well, we had most shows were just dubbed and then sent on multiple channels over here. Like, it's still done to this day. But I'm actually not sure if when the Twilight Zone, if it really came out in the 90s, maybe they redubbed the whole show and then brought it back in the 90s when that that new Twilight Zone came out. That was around that time, right? That was in the 90s.
Yeah, there was one. I think it was even in the 80s, I want to say, is when one of those, because I want to say there was an 80s and then there was a kind of late 90s, early 2000s.
I'm just going to look. Yeah, there was one in 2002 and one in 1985. Okay, 85. So that's a bit before. Because that would have been like my guess that they maybe, we're gonna do the new show that's gonna also come out in Germany, and so let's re-edit all the redub all the old ones and bring them out as well.
Yeah, it's possible.
But, yeah, who knows? I'll try to read into that for next week.
But either way, the episode we're talking about today is Time Enough at Last. It was based on a short story by Lynn Venable, and I actually found as I was in my moving, I have this Twilight Zone. I'd sent you a picture, but I've got the second edition of the Twilight Zone Companion, and it's just a huge book that not only talks about each of the episodes, got some cool history about Rod Serling, and then there's a whole section in here as I was flipping through about Richard Matheson and his writing and how he influenced in some of the episodes he wrote.
Yeah.
So it's actually a really cool book. And I'm excited as we continue to work through this to read on every episode. But this one was based on a short story by Lynn Venable, I think is how you would say it. The pen name of Marilyn Venable. And it appeared in the Worlds of Science Fiction. It was a science fiction magazine, which was huge. Back then, you know, everybody was submitting these short stories to these magazines. Stars the great Burgess Meredith, who we talked about a little bit last week when we were getting ready for this, and also some other good, some really good performances in there, but I think he's kind of the standout. I'm trying to, the book doesn't have everybody listed, like the cast and things like, it does right there. You got Miss Carsville was Vaughn Taylor, who she was really funny, or he was really funny, Mr. Carsville. Yeah. Helen Bemis, Jacqueline DeWitt, and there was a woman in the bank, Leila Bliss, who was very funny. But the story, this is one of the ones as I was kind of reading through this companion guide. They said this is one of the few where the Rod Serling actually took the short story and expanded upon it a lot. Like the Bemis in the short story didn't have a lot of character and didn't have a lot of motivation. He was just kind of there to tell this post-apocalyptic story, whereas Rod Serling actually fleshed him out a little bit. And the one scene in particular they said wasn't in the book was Bemis talking to the woman at the bank at the very beginning, which we'll get to that. I guess I should do the intro real quick.
Yeah, do the intro.
We'll do the opening narration, and then let me get a drink here. Clear my throat for just a second before I start doing this. So here is the opening narration for Time Enough at Last. Witness Mr. Henry Bemis, a charter member in the Fraternity of Dreamers, a bookish little man whose passion is the printed page, but who is conspired against by a bank president and a wife and a world full of tongue cluckers and the unrelenting hands of a clock. But in just a moment, Mr. Bemis will enter a world without bank presidents, or wives, or clocks, or anything else. He'll have a world all to himself, without anyone. So there's our opening narration. So we do open with Bemis, and I love the scene with Bemis and the woman at the bank. And he's
so excited about this book. Like, he's telling her all about it.
Yeah.
And this is great, and that. And then there's this character who does, and she's just standing there. You shorten me again.
Right.
I get one more dollar.
Yeah. You shortchanged me, Bemis. Yeah, because he asked her, like, have you read David Copperfield? There's this great villain, Murdstone. Isn't that a villainous name, Murdstone? And he just wants to talk to anybody. Like, it doesn't matter. This guy loves books. His passion for books runs so deep. And as I was reading the production notes, I read that they actually used a couple different types of glasses to make his eyes look humongous like that. Like, there's no prescription that makes your eyes look that way. They just wanted him to look, and it was a fake mustache that they put on him at the same time. And again, reading about it, they said Burgess Meredith was so easy to work with. They said the guy was just phenomenal, and he knew exactly what you wanted to do at all times. He understood who this character was. And then later in life, they had talked to Burgess Meredith about it. And he said, not a week has gone by in my life that people don't mention this episode of The Twilight Zone. Because as we talked about last week, he did three more episodes of the show. But it was this one that everybody continually would just come up and talk to him over and over. And for a lot of people, it's considered probably one of the best episodes of the show.
Yeah, so, for sure. It's also, I think, one of the first ones I've ever seen. Because I've heard of this before and searched it out a long time ago and watched it online.
Yeah, because and there's so many pop culture references, and this thing's been used in satire. I think I even saw an episode of The Simpsons where they did something along these lines. But I've seen this play out so many times. And so Bemis, after this woman, you shortchanged me. You didn't give me enough money. He gets talked to by the – or wait, he goes home first and he gets talked to the next day?
No, he first gets talked to by the boss. That's the
– okay.
First thing that happens, and the boss tells him already that he's that, like, he tells him, my wife won't let me read and I can't read on the way, I have to read here, and the boss just says, like, you have a great wife and be happy she yada yada something about
yeah.
It's
he pretty much tells him the same, like, books are dumb and you gotta quit reading, Bemis. Like, you're here for one thing and you're not doing it. Like, you're not even doing the right stuff that you're supposed to be doing. And then he even tells him about the some woman thought that Bemis was harassing her because he was trying to read the buttons, her campaign button.
yeah
and I just wanted to see who she voted for. So Bemis, we learn, and it's so weird to think about a world where there's so many people who are so against books. But Bemis lives in this world where no one allows him to read anything, and he even gives this great talk about when he's talking to the boss about his wife, you know, taking everything away. He can't read the paper, he can't read anything at all, so he reads the condiment bottles, and you know, he'll read whatever he can get his hands on.
Yeah.
And then we do get to meet his wife after this. He goes home for the day, and that was what was her name? Jacqueline DeWitt. And she was good. She's awful. She's an awful human being.
She's horrible. I love when he says, like, she says something about, like, one of her men not talking to her. And he asks, like, why did she say one of your men? Do you have another one? And she's like, why are you rubbing this in my face? Like,
right.
she just despises him. She's like the wife, the husband from a few weeks ago, the sick husband who doesn't like his wife.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. She's the same way to him.
Yeah, she really is. She does not like him whatsoever and despises the fact that he reads. And yeah, he corrects her grammar. That's what it was. What kind of a husband? And he's like, a husband? Well, how many do you, you know, he's laughing about it. How many do you have? Yeah. Yada, yada, yada.
Exactly.
And so they're gonna play bridge, and she's now telling him, you know, well, get your stuff ready, this and that, and he's hiding. We see him hiding books and stuff in the furniture. He's got like books of poetry and these tiny little paperbacks stuffed in the couch and stuffed in the chairs. And then she even asked him, which is really cruel. She's like, hey, why don't you read to me some of the poetry that you got over there? Read me one of your books. And he gets excited. He's like, oh, you know, we got Frost and Shaw and all these guys. He starts naming off all these great poets. Like, I can't wait. He's holding this book like it's the Holy Grail. And he's so excited. And then he opens it up and she scribbled all over all the pages.
Yeah, and then she also rips it in half and like rips all the pages out, and she's just really mean to him.
Yeah, and so Bemis is kind of beat down. We now see Bemis, you know, a very sympathetic character. You feel for him. It's like the guy just wants to do this thing that's not hurting anybody.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes, it's, you know, a hobby that most people would say is a really good hobby. You're learning along the way, and Bemis is pretty beat down. Move on to the next day. Bemis is back at the bank, and it's interesting that they allow him to just go into the vault to read. He can,
yeah.
I guess they were a little more relaxed with the vault procedures, because now you see it in movies or anything like that, and you need two different people's thumbprints on different sides of the vault at any given time to get in. Bemis is allowed to just go down there on his lunch and read his books. And we did get the shot of the newspaper, though, that foreshadows the foreshadows.
I don't know. It was more like, you know what's going to happen now?
Boom. Right. Yeah. But even though they kind of give us that in the opening narration, though, that last word is he'll have a world all to himself without anyone. We know where it's going. But yeah, you see that, like, newspaper.
The newspaper like title says H-bomb capable of total destruction. And once you're done reading it, you get a loud explosion and the whole room shakes.
Yeah. And I was reading in this book about that whole set right there, the entire vault, the camera and the entire set were built on springs. So the whole thing was actually shaking. It wasn't just the camera that was shaking.
Couldn't they just shake the camera a little bit? That's enough.
Yeah, normally, but I guess not. That's what they wanted to do.
They just wanted to really have a shaky room for fun.
Yeah, so they built this entire room to shake, which I thought, and there's another production thing we'll talk about in a minute I thought was really cool, but they built this whole room to shake. So Bemis is down there and just everything starts going, and we realize that the H-bomb is hit. And at that time, though, you know, you think in 59, that was still a real fear for a lot of people, because that happened not too long ago, and everybody was still scared of this idea, you know, the Russians bombing us or whoever bombing us. But the idea of nuclear war was still real in a lot of people's minds. They still remembered that. You had a whole generation of people that was only, you know, a decade, a little over a decade earlier, where that stuff had actually taken place. So it was a real fear. So Beamus is down there. Everything shakes up and he slowly emerges. We do get that middle narration, which you'd get every once in a while in the Twilight Zone. Yeah. You got that.
I think when IMDb actually said it's only 4 episodes in which he does it. The first one was Walking Distance,
yeah,
which we talked about. And then this one, and then I shot an arrow into the air and I sing the body electric.
Oh, I like
those. So 2 in 59, 1 in 60, and 1 in 62. That's all we get with middle narrations.
And he was really still very nervous. They said the whole first season, you rarely see him on screen doing the narrations because he would sweat. He would get sick. Oh, like,
is he going to come out later on and actually be on screen for the narrations?
Yeah, he comes out later on. Yeah. And he's on screen for a lot of their narrations. But they said they would have to like joke with him. A lot of the cast would have to really try and loosen him up because he was terrified of being in front of the camera. He didn't like it at all.
Like I said before, that always at the end of the episodes for me, there's a short opener where Mr. Serling tells you about what's going to happen next week. And then he always looks kind of not happy to be in front of a camera. Let's say that.
And that's a lot of times in those ones right there that you're talking about, kind of the advertisement for the next week. And even when once he starts showing up on screen, a lot of the time he was smoking and he'd have a cigarette in his hand. And there were also times where he would, they wouldn't even tell him the camera was rolling. They would say, well, just practice it one time and we'll see what happens. But they would actually roll the camera to see if they could capture it while he, because it was once the camera was on, he would get a little more nervous.
Yeah.
Yeah. Serling was great. So we'll do this. I'll do this middle narration really quick. And this is kind of the halfway point of the episode. Okay. So here we go. This happens right after the bomb hits and Beamus, is now kind of out of the vault, seeing the aftermath of the H-bomb. Seconds, minutes, hours. They crawl by on hands and knees for Mr. Henry Beamus, who looks for a spark in the ashes of a dead world. A telephone connected to nothingness. A neighborhood bar, a movie, a baseball diamond, a hardware store. The mailbox of what was once his house is now a rubble. They lie at his feet as battered monuments to what was but is no more. Mr. Henry Beamus on an 8-hour tour of a graveyard. And so now we're out there. We're out into the world. And this was the other production thing I was going to tell you about is the guy who... I think it was the director is what they had said. It was the George Clemens. So I think he was, the director behind it. Let me double check here.
The director of the episode is John Brahm.
Okay, so Clemens was the director of photography. And he did, so they built these sets after the bomb. You had these set pieces where Beamus was and... In order to bring out these clouds and stuff, this Clemens, this director of photography, decided to use this blue filter, which had never been used before. And he ended up having to leave to go to court, I think is what it said. He ended up having to leave to go to court. And so the person he left in charge was terrified to even try and do this stuff, to use this filter. It was like this new technology at the time. Not even technology. It was just something nobody had tried yet. And this guy was like, put it on there. I want the clouds to look a little bit better. So it's kind of cool. You know, they were discovering new ways to shoot television, but I love the soundstage look of it all.
Yeah.
And these,
of all the episodes, right? Like it's just something like classic.
Yeah. There's something about it that it was a period in time when movies were still transitioning from the stage and they were shooting it in a lot of the same ways before getting on location. Just to save money, everything was in one spot. You could reuse different sets. And these stairs, they actually used in a few different things. But so Beamus is now out and about and really goes to some dark places. And especially once you get right near the end of the episode, you see a man truly fall into the pit of loneliness. And that's a topic that we've discussed before even... Was it last week was the lonely where it was? Yeah. Kind of the same
last
thing.
Last week and the first episode ever of the Twilight Zone was also about loneliness.
Oh yeah. The, what was the name?
Where is everybody?
Where is everybody? But Bemis is lonely, and I, you know, the H-bomb for some reason didn't destroy everything. It just killed all the people, but there was still food. He found a bunch of cans of food, and Bemis is wandering around, and he's hollering, "Helen, Helen, can you hear me?" He's looking for anybody to be friends with, but there's nobody there, and Bemis reaches the point of suicide, which I thought was a really good performance by Burgess Meredith. Where he's, you know, he has that line of dialogue and he says something along the lines of, I'll be forgiven, won't I, given the circumstances. As he's got this gun and he's contemplating shooting himself, and then he looks over and sees the sign for the public library. And it's like the heavens open up and Bemis now has he has an out. He has something he can finally do, and he realizes it. And so he starts collecting up all these books, and he's got piles. And he's got, oh, this will be January. This will be February. This will be March. He's ready to finally. Yeah. And that's where we get the title of the episode comes from, where he says, there's time now. There's time enough at last. And then the cruel, cruel fates. This is, it's so brutal.
It's so brutal. Like this character is down on his luck all the time throughout the episode, and then there's like a sign of happiness for him, a sign of a happy end for him, even though the world was eliminated. And what happens is he stumbles. No, he looks for some book that lays on the ground, looks down, and his glasses fall off.
Yeah,
and we've seen a few times before that without his glasses, he's blind.
Yeah.
He doesn't see anything.
And now there's no one to get him a prescription. So Bemis is now trapped in this world. And it really is such a gut punch. He's trapped in this world where all he wanted to do was read. And that one thing was stripped away from him. He bends over to pick up a book. His glasses fall off. And we just see him shatter on the ground. And it's heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. Yeah.
It's probably the saddest episode we had so far.
Easily the saddest episode. And this is one of the ones, kind of like last week, though, where we're now getting to this place where the Twilight Zone, you get that very cruel, ironic ending to some of these episodes. And this is one of them. This is a showcase for sure. Yeah. But a great episode. Oh, it's such a good one.
It's really, really good.
And okay, so we'll wrap up with the closing narration, which I thought was really interesting that they used of Mice and Men, because you know he did the film adaptation of Mice and Men, Burgess Meredith. Okay, but here we go. The best laid plans of Mice and Men and Henry Bemis, the small man in the glasses who wanted nothing but time. Henry Bemis, now just a part of a smashed landscape. Just a piece of rubble, just a fragment of what man has deemed to himself. Mr. Henry Bemis in the Twilight Zone. And it was deeded to himself, not deemed to himself. Sorry about that. But that was a good one.
Yes, and we got to add, because I'm not sure if we said it already, this was one of the episodes that Serling himself wrote.
Yeah.
Like usually he's just like... Well, he's always the producer. He's always behind it, but he was the writer on this episode.
Yeah, he took that story and made it his own. He did a lot of those where he would take it and kind of, you know, make it his own and make it a little bit better. Take these short stories in these science fiction magazines, and there's a really cool French adaptation that we're getting to is one of the few that, well, we'll talk about it when we get there.
We'll talk about it.
Yeah. And so, and
next week we're going to talk about Perchance to Dream, or how is it Perchance? I don't know how to say that word.
I think it's Perchance. Yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah.
I don't remember that one. So I'm excited to watch it again to see what's happening there, because it's always something interesting with the Twilight Zone.
It's a good one, and I was kind of looking at it a little bit. This one is actually based on a story that was first published in Playboy, which is kind of funny. And then after that one, I peeked ahead a little bit. After that one, we get into our first episode about the Germans. Yeah. Judgment Night.
Can't wait.
Judgment Night. It's a good one. All right. So with Twilight Zone wrapped up for this week, we'll get on to our main topic that we want to discuss today. And it was an idea that you had because you had been, or you had just picked up a copy of Suspiria.
I started watching it exactly. I got it a few weeks ago and finally got around to watching it. And I couldn't finish it for this episode, but at least for what we're going to talk about today, it's enough already. Because, my idea was, let's talk about remakes. Because remakes are a big part of horror movies. There's some of the biggest horror movies in the world are remakes. And some of them you don't maybe even know about that they are remakes.
And that's what I was surprised as I was kind of looking through. You know, there was a lot of them that I knew were remakes, but then others that I wasn't familiar. But I wanted to start with, you know, and ask you, in your eyes, because as I thought about remakes, most of the time the movies that get remade are either super obscure that people don't know it's a remake, or they're movies that already have a built-in fan base. They were good movies to begin with and successful movies to begin with. And so these production companies, just based on title alone, know that they'll get a certain return on investment because you already have an established fan base. Yeah. But in your eyes, there's not many remakes that I think are great or better than the originals. But what makes a good remake? When they're remaking something, what makes it good?
Yeah, well, that's something I've been thinking about a lot because for the longest time, I hated remakes because I was like a purist and I was really like a film snob for a while. And I was really like, remakes are always shit because they don't add anything. You can just watch the original. And I've kind of changed on that in that remakes can be great. I'd say you said there aren't many. I'd say there are quite a few remakes that are better than the original. But most of those are actually remakes of movies that are that were shit or like unknown. Those are the ones that you don't really know why they made a remake of it. But most of the time, it's probably because the people that made the movie were really into the original for some reason. Like with let me start off the list with The Thing, which is the remake of a movie from the 50s that no one knows.
Right. Yeah. The who did the original? Was it Howard Hughes?
I think he produced it. I don't think he directed it. Let me look it up. The original title is, I think, The Thing from Another World.
Yeah, it's a longer title. Yeah, it's The Thing from Another World.
Yeah, and it's directed by
Howard Hawks, not Howard Hughes. Howard Hawks.
Howard Hawks. Yeah, so it's directed by officially by Christian Nyby,
right?
And by Howard Hawks without credit. Probably because like he was a producer and always behind it.
And it was both were based on Who Goes There, which I had a chance to read at the very end of last year. Maybe it was earlier this year. I had a chance to read the short story.
All right.
Which is really cool. It's and then I actually got to read the follow-up story to Who Goes There, that stuff that they had found. It's not a follow-up, I guess, but they found a bunch of unreleased material that he had written.
The full story, basically?
Yeah.
Like he had a full story and then made it into a short story for some reason.
Yeah, and you get a lot in the full one. You get a lot more of them at the camp, and it was good. It was a fun read. But yes, you know, produced, I guess, by, like you said, by Howard Hawks because he was the bigger name at the time. But 100%, I agree with you there that the Carpenter version is the superior version. In almost every way.
And here it's, I think here it's more of a case of Howard Hawks, you know, Carpenter.
John Carpenter?
You just said it and I still forgot it again. So Carpenter probably watched The Thing, probably as a kid. He saw it early on, the original, and that's probably the reason why he made that remake, which is, that's what I liked. Those are mostly the best remakes. He just liked the idea and made his own out of it.
Yeah,
like it's still a station somewhere in the Arctic, and there's still a crew of people, and there's still an alien coming down.
Right.
But what the alien does and how it reacts is totally different, because in the original, it's kind of like this plant-based life form, which is like just like a humanoid with lots of green on him. And he's attacking the station. And with the thing, it's that he made something completely different out of it.
Absolutely. Carpenter, and he must have, I mean, he's got to love the movie, because he even put it in Halloween. It's, you know, when Tommy's watching the movie while he's being babysat, they're watching The Thing from Another World keep showing up on TV. And I don't know if that had to do with, you know, rights. I don't know if it was public domain at the time. Who knows? But he did put it in his movie. So he's got to have some sort of love for it. But it is one of the few cases in my eyes where it's not just better, it's worlds apart, you know.
Yeah, it's the thing. The Carpenter version is a remake. Is a classic.
Yeah.
The original is a movie that has been forgotten already if it wasn't for Carpenter.
And I would say another one along the same lines is The Fly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, The Fly is one of the few that I hold up as being the superior in almost every way. The 86 version, I don't remember what year. It was in the 50s. I don't remember what year the Vincent Price version of the, even though I do like the little fly when he's in the spider's web. Help me, help me.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's screaming for somebody to help him. But this is
the 50s, yeah.
This is where I think remakes do work, is when you have a movie that's been gone for a long time, where the audience for the remake is not the same audience that was fans of the original. And they weren't there when the original happened and took place. Even with something, you know, something's been pulled out of the public consciousness. You think about even Friday the 13th, that remake we got in 2009, I want to say, was the remake.
Yeah.
You still weren't that far removed from, because what year was Jason X, and then you had Freddy versus Jason. It's a character that was still part of the conversation. It was still in the public consciousness for the most part. Everybody knew who Jason Voorhees was, and yeah, they went to remake this thing. And so it's hard because you have people who are so attached to this character as it was. And I think with the Friday the 13th remake, I love the opening. I think the opening's great. The kids in the searching for the weed, all going out and camping together, and Jason just shows up and slaughters everybody, and then it takes a kind of a crazy turn. And then in even a worse scenario, you have a movie like Cabin Fever that was remade after only a handful of years. Cabin Fever, the original had been out, and then they what year was 2016? They remade Cabin Fever, and what was Eli Roth's? It had to have been early.
Yeah, that was 2000 or 2001, yeah, sometime, or maybe 2002, like early 2000s.
Early 2000s.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy, and I don't know why they do that. Like, but since we're at remakes coming close together, I just I gotta ask you this, because I looked at a few lists and looked, so what's like the best remakes. And there was this list of on Rotten Tomatoes of the best remakes of all time. And the number one spot, and I want to ask you about this, the number one spot is Evil Dead 2. Because
yeah,
it's basically a remake of the first movie, theoretically.
In theory, yes. In practical application, I still see them as two independent movies. And the only reason I don't consider it so much a remake in the traditional sense is because Raimi just went and made the movie that he couldn't make the first time because he didn't have the money. And so he wasn't really remaking Evil Dead. He's like, this is the movie I wanted to make to begin with. I just couldn't do it. Like, I'm yeah, sorry, and I want to use the same name. And the story is a bit different, but it's so disjointed and kind of all over the place. Because if you try and look at it in a traditional kind of canon order or chronological order, there's so many things that are out of place. And it's like, okay, well, wasn't he already here? He knows not to go back here. So in a lot of, I don't know. I just don't call it a remake because of the intention behind it. He didn't go in saying, I'm going to remake The Evil Dead. He's like, finally, I get to make the movie I wanted to make the first time around. and this is just what it is. And we all know and love The Evil Dead now, but at the time, you know, people didn't have access to movies the way we have access to movies now. So not a lot of people probably had even seen the first Evil Dead. You know, it was there. It was popular. It was wildly popular just because Stephen King gave him that quote. That's what really gave him all the money. Stephen King was nice enough to say, like, the most fiercely original horror movie of the year or something like that. So that really helped out. But I don't know that I would consider it a remake. One, because it's called Evil Dead 2. And, you know, that kind of indicates right there it's not a remake if they put a sequel number next to it. But in execution, yes, you can see it as kind of a remake. I don't know. It's a weird question. Yeah, it's a weird one.
I would never have thought of it as a remake because also there is an Evil Dead remake from 2013, which is also not bad, but that's not a great remake. That's just a good, fun, let's go back to this world, I'd say.
Yeah, see, and I really like the Evil Dead remake because I thought what I enjoy in a remake is when they stay true to the core story, just the basic story is there. Like you got the bones and then they put new flesh over top of the bones and put new veins and breathe new life into it. When it's not a shot for shot remake, something like a Psycho where it's, you know, almost.
I've written that down as well. Even though the Psycho's shot for shot remake is, I think I couldn't watch it through because when I started watching it, I just wanted to watch the original again.
Yeah.
But with that remake, I think that was not the case of let's do a cash grab or something. I think there was actually a choice by the director, by his who's the director again? He's really good director usually. Let me see.
1990. It was 98, right?
Yeah, Gus Van Sant.
Oh yes.
He made the remake, and he's like one of those artistic directors. He wants to do something, and so I think he made that just because he wanted to try something different, because there aren't many shot for shot remakes, and he wanted to see what would happen if he did it. That's what I guess. And
it's just so hard because those are the ones where why remake it? What's the point? Like, what are you trying to do with something that's considered, you know, one of the most iconic horror movies of all time? At least one of the most iconic horror scenes.
He clearly knew what the original Psycho was missing, and that's...
Is that what it was?
It's Norman Bates masturbating. That's what the movie was missing.
Yeah, that's really the only difference we get is him peeking through that hole and rubbing one out. So weird.
But yeah, I like when these when they do something when they, like you said, really just take the core idea and make something new out of it. I think maybe my favorite remake that's in existence is probably the Dawn of the Dead remake.
Yes, it I wouldn't say it's my favorite in existence, but Zack Snyder did, and I'm not a huge Zack Snyder fan, but he did something really cool there. And it holds a special place in my heart. That one, it was right after I graduated from boot camp. So I got out of boot camp, and the first thing, like, my mom came and my sister came, and they all watched me graduate. And then once you get done with boot camp, you get, like, a weekend to spend with your family. So I went out and got some, you know, greasy food, all this stuff. And they were like, hey, what do you want to do? And I said, first thing I want to do, I was like, I want to go to the movies. Just take me to the movies. I don't even care what's playing. I want to go to the movies. And so we went, and Dawn of the Dead was playing. So me and my sister, my mom went and did something else. I don't remember. But me and my sister went and checked out this movie. And it really, it's in my eyes, it's Zack Snyder's best movie. And it is an amazing remake. The way it opens up with that Johnny Cash playing is just so good. And the movie throughout is so good. Like, he took the story. And the thing about Dawn of the Dead, the original, is Romero at that time, you know, was trying to make this commentary about consumerism and the mindlessness of where our culture was headed. And he did something cool with it. But it's not a very deep story. There's not a lot there. There are those elements of it where you could say, oh, that's, you know, it's commentary on this, it's commentary on that. But the core story, is pretty basic. You get a bunch of people who are trapped in the mall trying to survive the zombie apocalypse. And Zack Snyder captured that really well. And he also gave us some awesome practical effects, some really cool gore. And it was just a ton of fun. That movie's a ton of fun.
And the writing is great because, of course, it was written by James Gunn.
Right.
The now like one of the highest regarded directors out there when it comes to blockbuster movies. And that movie is just, I think that's my favorite remake and one of my favorite movies in general. I just love it. Watched it a few times already. And I actually want to watch it again right now because I started talking about it.
Yeah, it's one that I would like to go back in. It's one that I turn on quite a bit. If, you know, I'll just have it playing in the background. It'll pop up somewhere and I'm like, oh, I like that movie. I really like that movie. But yeah, James Gunn, his writing is so unique and such a, you know, he's like a Kevin Smith or a Quentin Tarantino. You can almost always tell when James Gunn has been behind. One of my favorite video games he did, Lollipop Chainsaw. He wrote that, which was, again, and James Gunn, you know, even in Lollipop Chainsaw in the game, the girl who you play as, she went to Romero High School. Like, he has a love for this stuff. It's not, it's not just a cash grab. And I think you and I have talked about Super, how great of a movie Super is.
Yes.
And he was the writer on that as well. But yeah,
he also directed it.
Yeah, that's a good one. And so we've talked about some good ones. The only other one I'll say that I watched it again recently and I was like, you know what? And there's a lot I haven't seen on the remake list, but it was one where I was like, it's not as bad as everybody makes it out to be. Well, not even everybody makes it out to be. A lot of people, I know some people like it better than the original, but the remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And
which I should say I really love because it was one of my first horror movies I've ever seen.
Yeah. And you know, it's not a terrible remake. I think for me, the reason that I still don't think it's a great remake or think it's even really that good of a remake is they missed one very important element of what made that original movie so good. And this might sound a little bizarre, but to me, they lacked the family dynamic. You had Sheriff Hoyt, who was so good. Like, his character was just a disgusting, vile monster. And then you had the old man in the wheelchair. You had kind of the mom figure, the grandmother figure at the store, who she was really good. But we never got them all together. And to me, that's what made Texas Chainsaw so good, is even though they were a bunch of crazy, demented people, they were still a family unit and acted like a family. But we never saw any of that in the remake. You never really got any of them together. They were always separated and off in these different places. But the core story was still there, and it was pretty good. And I thought Leatherface was decent in that movie. But I just feel like, and that's where I say, you know, you got to start with the bones of what made the movie good. And they missed one of those important bones. Like, the spine of that movie was the family and them being a family unit, even though they were a very twisted family. You know, look what your brother did to the door. And he's chasing him in and whacking him with a stick. And then you have this dinner scene, this whole family getting together for a nice meal.
You talk about this movie almost like if someone hasn't seen that movie and hears you talk about it, fun family film.
Yeah,
you have a big dinner scene. That's nice. Yeah. Sounds like a great family.
It really is. It was a good one. And then the last one up before we get into some of the bad remakes, what are your thoughts on the 1990 version of Night of the Living Dead?
I've actually written that down, and I so it's basically it's very close to the original.
Right.
Like, it doesn't really bring anything new to the table other than one big thing. And that is that Tom Savini directed it and did the special effects.
Right.
And the gore is what that movie, and also I really like Tony Todd in general, but mostly it's the gore that's really, that makes that movie good, that makes that movie fun and worth watching. Because if the gore was on the same level as the original as well, then I think there would be nothing really in that movie worth watching, because you can just watch the original.
Just watch the original. And he was so close to it, though. I mean, he had already done a bunch of effects work on the other Of the Dead movies. You know, yeah. he was close to George. And I like it as a remake. And you're right, they just kind of told the same story but up the ante when it came to the gore and the yeah. I like the wasn't that the there was a big fat zombie? Like a right in the house as they go in, I want to say.
Oh yeah, a giant zombie. Like he was like just like almost a ball, I think.
yeah, he was huge. But that is another one that I don't mind the remake, and part of it is maybe just because I love that movie so much. But in the same way, I love Psycho so much, but feel like that remake was unnecessary. And yeah. not to take away from George Romero at all. But Romero and Hitchcock were two very different directors. And when Romero made Night of the Living Dead, he was trying to get his start in the world. He never knew.
What's his first movie?
Yeah, he never knew it was going to be as big as he was. When Hitchcock made Psycho, he was in a place of this has to work. And so he was meticulous with everything. Like every detail, every shot was just done over and over until it was exactly what he wanted it to be.
And as much as I like George Romero, when we talk about great directors, Alfred Hitchcock is just like miles above Romero.
Yeah, he was something. He was something special. I was watching, you know, one of Hitchcock's not horror stuff a couple nights ago. I was watching To Catch a Thief, which I absolutely love with Cary Grant and Grace Kelly. Great movie, but. Yeah, they're worlds apart as far as, you know, directing goes. And I won't even ever say one was, you know, better than the other. I think one had more movies than the other. But to me, Night of the Living Dead is still a masterpiece.
To me as well.
But with this remake, I do like the 1990 version. And it's something maybe I'll throw that on later on because it's something I would like to revisit. And there's been so many Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, isn't there also one from a bit later, even with Sid Haig?
Yeah, that was the Night of the Living Dead 3D.
Yeah.
Yeah,
which I've heard is really bad.
I saw it in the theater. Yeah, it's pretty bad, man. It's so many. It's kind of in the same way that Friday the 13th Part 3, the 3D elements almost seem, you know, like they wrote the script just for those few 3D moments. Like, you'll have a bunch of people sitting around smoking weed and somebody would be like, hey, take a hit, and then shove their hand way up into the screen, you know. So it was, yeah. Or, you know, point a stick directly at the screen. It was something. There was a bunch of that little stuff in there. I want to say it's on Prime right now, maybe. You should check it out. It's bad, but you should check it out.
Anyway. I should. I will. I love Sid Haig, so I want to see it at some point.
Yeah, you should. You should give that a go.
But before we go into the bad remakes, I've got a few more good ones actually that we haven't talked about yet. A few that I actually like a lot. Like one of them is The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah, and that's another one that's weird though. I saw it on the list, but is it a remake?
It's more of a sequel. Yeah, it's they're making basically the exact same movie again, just with the twist that the same movie happened, came out, and now someone's recreating it.
Yeah, like how do you remake something and then acknowledge it as having existed in the same world where your movie is taking place?
Yeah, it's really a weird hybrid thing. Another one I got though that's a remake for sure is The Hills Have Eyes.
Yeah, that was a good remake.
Because I like that a lot actually. It's not a great movie, but it's fun, and they up the gore and have basically, it's also basically the same version like the Night of the Living Dead remake, where it's basically the exact same movie, just more modern, because what Wes Craven did in the 70s, he didn't have lots of budget for that movie. That was really early on in his career, and you could see that, and now they had quality actors. They had good cameras, good special effects, and so I like that one. I've got three more, then we can get into the bad ones. The Maniac remake. Maniac.
That's a good one.
That's another one where they didn't take a great movie. They took a movie with an interesting idea of this serial killer that collects
body parts.
What's,
Because he collects mannequins.
Yeah, and puts the scalps of his victims on them.
Yeah.
And that movie, I watched that movie, the main actor looks like Ron Jeremy. And it's still like he's the one, he's getting all the girls in that movie. And then in the remake, we have Elijah Wood as the main character, who I believe more that he would get girls. But then again, they made his character really awkward. Like,
and they did a really good job, though, of taking an actor that we had known for so many other things and putting him into a role. Like, for Elijah Wood to even take the role to begin with. But I've seen him since then. So many, you know, behind-the-scenes stuff and people interviewing. When that documentary, I can't remember what it was called. It was Numbers. It was the one about the shower scene in Psycho. It was it was like the number of takes that it had. Yeah. But that documentary was really cool. But he's a horror fan. Like you listen to him talking, and he really. I'm gonna see if I can look that up real quick. But he is a horror fan.
Yeah, he's really big into it. And he was really big on promoting that movie Cooties he made.
That movie was great. Did you watch Cooties?
It's so much fun. Yeah, yeah. I own it on DVD. It's so much fun. But like in the end, it's a cheaper movie about kids turning into zombies.
Right. Yeah, that movie was a ton. Oh, and this was called 78-52. Yeah, 78-52. Okay. It was cool. Because it was 78 camera setups that they had did, and 52 cuts were in those couple of minutes of film. No, Cooties was great, man. Because who else was in there with him? There was him, Rainn Wilson. Yeah,
it had a big cast in general.
Yeah, and those little kids were great, and they were just murdering children left and right.
And that's fun. Yeah, but also what we got to add about Maniac is just that. Elijah, that it was all that they made something new out of it by having it all from the perspective of the serial killer.
Right.
It was completely not just we're following him. No, we're in his head. We are seeing through his eyes. And they really made a great movie, I think, that is way above the original.
Yeah, it was. That movie blew my mind. The first time I watched it, I did not expect it to be what it was. And I had seen Maniac. Like, I knew the story. But that remake, you're right. That's a good one. That's a very good one.
Yeah. Then I got one that I just want to mention because I haven't seen the original and can talk on it. But the 70s version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That's another one of those 50s remakes, like remakes of movies from the 50s that surpassed them. And now no one thinks about the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Everyone talks about the 70s version.
Because it was the kind of the other one that we had talked about maybe a month or two ago that I had watched. Toby Hooper's Invaders from Mars was a remake as well. And a lot of those stories were the same, you know, when you had everybody afraid of communists and you didn't know who your neighbor was and people were terrified, but you're right. That version is the better version.
Yeah, sure. And that movie is like they made that so many times with just different setups in general. Like I talked not too long ago about what's it called again? Stepford Wives, which is also basically that movie, just a bit different. Or we get Rodriguez, the Faculty, which is also the same story, just like a bit different. But I wouldn't count those as remakes. Those are just taking the core concept and making something completely new out of it.
Right, which a lot of stories, you know, you hear it said that there are no new stories anymore.
Yeah.
Every original story's already been told, and now people are just doing variations on these old stories, but Invasion of the Body Snatchers, it's not, you can always do some weird things, but Invasion of the Body Snatchers, that's a good one. And there was a remake of, I don't know if you ever saw the remake of Earth versus the Spider from 2001. I really like the original Earth versus the Spider, and I wouldn't say that it's a better movie, but it's still a fun movie. To be fair, though, I'm a sucker for any kind of a creature feature. I don't care what it is. I watch all the dumb shit, and I still, especially spiders. I've always loved giant spider movies. They were, and you know, you talk about somebody taking an idea and making it their own. Eight-Legged Freaks was very much just a love letter to the monster movies of the 50s.
Yeah.
While kind of being its own movie at the same time.
Okay, yeah, I still got to see that. I own it here. I got it on DVD. I'm going to throw it on at some point.
Yeah, it's fun.
And the last one I got that is, I think, almost as good, if not even maybe a bit better than the original, is The Ring.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, it's they're really close. What I like about the remake is that it just, in maybe it's because it's an American movie, so it's easier to connect. But something kept me off the original. Maybe when I first watched it, I watched it in a bad dub, and that really lessened the impact. But I think the remake just is. Higher production value, and that helped for this movie, I feel
it,
like.
It helps, and with though that's an interesting subgenre of remakes, where it's foreign to English language remakes, because they do adapt them for the audience, because the audience is used to certain tropes and certain styles. And with The Ring, specifically with Japanese ghost horror, you have to view those movies through the lens of the culture, because they tell ghost stories in a very different way. And The Ring is a really good example of that. And even the, which one was The Grudge? Was The Ring Junon? No, Ring is Ringu. Ringu. Yeah, it was The Grudge. So you have to watch those through the lens of the audience they're intended for. And they're very different. You can't go into Ringu with an American set of eyes, or I shouldn't even say an American set of eyes, but with a Western set of eyes, and expect it to be, you know, made for you, because it's made for a culture that, you know, likes their movies in a very different way when it comes to ghost stories and things like that. But I would say I like the, man, that's a tough one, because I like them both for different reasons.
Yeah.
But the English version was really good.
What really jumps into it for me is that I've seen the remake way before I saw the original. I saw that when it was one of the first horror movies I saw. So it always holds a special kind of place in my heart. And it's probably for that reason alone, I like that one more than the original, even though I'm usually a big fan of original movies, especially Japanese movies.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That makes sense. That makes sense. So any other on your list of good remakes?
Let me see. The Wicker Man.
The Wicker Man.
One more. I just found it here. I'm not sure how I should count this. Is We Are What We Are, which is, I haven't seen the original once again.
I haven't either, but I've heard it's amazing.
Yeah, and the remake is really good, though. We can agree on that. That's another one where they just put it into a new language, basically.
Yeah, where they had adapted it. And yeah, it, you know, it was interesting because I picked it as a classic pick of the week on those movie guys, and Phil didn't like it. He's like, it's too slow, it's too slow. And for me, that's what made it great. It was just this slow burn. But then you get up to this, like, crescendo of an ending that was just insane. And I felt like the payoff was so good. But I have heard that the Spanish language version of that, the original version of We Are What We Are, is great. So I do want to see that sometime. I think I looked for it for a while and I couldn't find it. So I'm going to have to, maybe I didn't look hard enough, but I'm going to have to find that again, because I really like We Are What We Are.
Yeah, it's really good. So let's get into the bad ones.
Oh, the bad, because, man, there's a lot of bad out there when it comes to, you already mentioned The Wicker Man. Which is bad for, you know, one more good one, I guess, but some people don't like, but I really liked it, was The Wolfman from 2010, the Anthony Hopkins, Benicio del Toro Wolfman.
I've seen that forever ago. I don't recall much about it, but yeah, I've also heard like lots of people like it, but also lots that just hated it.
Yeah, and that's one that... You know, it's hard to even call it and I really like Emily Blunt. She's so good. It's a remake, but the Wolfman story is kind of, it's a folk tale. It's not even so much, I don't feel like you can pull from just a movie, but in this instance, it did follow the Lon Chaney Jr., the old Universal movie, Whereas you had, but in this one, you had some things that were added with his dad, you know.
But, one question, isn't the remake, if you call it that, like set in the in some totally different time period?
Like, yes.
Isn't it like because the original is set in the 1930s, right, or 40s?
Right, it was set at the time, and this one is just earlier. I don't remember the exact time period.
But like it's long ago, like in a totally different century.
Right. Yeah, because they were like horse and wagon, I want to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, they weren't in cars. So, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I do remember really liking it. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, so in general, with all these, I also didn't write any of those down because all these Universal classics, they got like, those are all basically public domain stories. And so like we have like 10,000 Dracula movies.
Right.
But I don't think we have any remake of the original Dracula movie. There are always new adaptations of the same book, of the same story.
Right. They're not a shock. I did turn on Bela Lugosi the other night when my cable went out and I had no internet, so I couldn't watch anything. So I pulled out the Blu-rays and turned on the first one. So good. The movie's so good. Yeah. And I still need to see the Spanish version of that one. But anyways, let's talk about some bad ones. Let's talk about the movies that have no reason to be remade to begin with. I'll kick it off with the Amityville Horror from 2005.
Still haven't seen that one. I want to see it because I love Ryan Reynolds, but yeah, I've heard so many bad things about it that I didn't watch it yet.
And it's hard when it comes to the bad ones. It's hard when the originals are so good. And the first Amityville, James Brolin, Margot Kidder, it's a staple in the world of horror. And it's one that, you know, I feel is pretty timeless. It doesn't really lose anything. A lot of the effects still look really good. And the remake just lost a ton of, and it was such a different time in the world for that remake to come out. And it's just a name that people know, Amityville. And there's been, I don't know how many sequels, like 7 or 8 different Amityville dollhouses, the Amity apartment, the Amity like church. There's been so many Amityville movies, but that remake is, it's just not there for me. Just didn't do it, man.
Yeah, it's, I've heard so many bad things about it that's, even though I love the story in general and I love the, I love Ryan Reynolds, but still I stayed away from that movie so far because everyone's hating on it.
Yeah, I would say just keep yourself away. the other one, so this one really hurt me. This one was tough. This one was from 2006, and it's a horror movie that I know anyone listening to this show has heard me talk about, and anyone listening to my other shows talk about it. They remade Black Christmas, and they took everything that made Black Christmas good and just shit all over it. Just shit all over it. The only thing it had going for it was a bunch of pretty ladies. You had like the who's who of young, beautiful actresses in this thing at the time. But what made Black Christmas so good is that we never really knew Billy. Like, you didn't know Billy. You didn't know who he was. You didn't know what his motivations were. You just got these obscene phone calls every once in a while. And in this one, you get Billy and his jaundice, you know, skin, and Agnes is an actual person in this one. It was just a complete garbage. Complete garbage.
Yeah, that's another one of those that I haven't watched yet. And I'm not too too into trying to find it and watch it because, yeah, it's probably shit.
It's bad, man. I almost want you to watch it just so you got to suffer through it the way that all the rest of us did. there were some cool moments, like Billy when he killed his mom, and I don't think it was his dad. I think it was his mom's boyfriend or fiance or something. He uses cookie cutters to cut pieces of their skin out and then bakes them in the oven like cookies. And so that was all right. But other than that, it's a bad movie. It's just not, comparatively, especially you compare it to that first one where Bob Clark was just so, he executed so well on making it feel like Christmas and making it truly scary. And yeah, that's a bad remake. All right. What do you got on your list? Because I could just keep going.
I don't have too many bad ones, but because I stayed away from remakes for a long time in general and then first searched out the good ones. So I'm still learning about the bad ones. But one that I'm not sure if it's completely bad, but since we're talking about remakes from movies from the 70s that give unnecessary backstory to their main antagonist, what about the Halloween remake by Rob Zombie?
Yeah, let's talk about the Halloween remake. I actually just let a friend of mine borrow. I've got the full, they released like 2 or 3 years ago, a big Blu-ray set with all, it came with all the movies and the producer's cut of part six. And I was like, hey, Tate, he's like, I never seen these Rob Zombie movies. I was like, just take the whole set. Watch what you want to watch and bring it back. The Rob Zombie remake, I really enjoyed the second half of that movie when Michael was just being Michael. Where Rob Zombie always kind of stumbles for me is that I truly think he believes that every person on the planet is just a white trash piece of shit. Like everybody, everybody's just awful. And I didn't want that whole Michael story. I wasn't opposed to seeing Michael as a kid, but his family were such scumbags that I was almost sympathetic to Michael. And I was like, yeah, man, I would have killed all them people too. Like they were horrible people, like just horrible. Yeah. His mom, you know, tried near the end, but she was a stripper, always fighting with who played the boyfriend. Was it Forsythe? William Forsythe?
And, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's like disgusting, talking about the daughter's ass at breakfast, and like I'm gonna come over there and what? I'll skull fuck you or something. But I hated those characters so very much. And Michael being the little demented Michael. But once Michael's an adult, I actually liked it. And I feel like the casting of, I really like Malcolm McDowell, but I feel like the casting of him as Dr. Loomis just didn't work. Because Donald Pleasance, he was very intense, but he could be lovable at the same time. Where I feel McDowell, and maybe it was the writing, he was just never likable. He was never a likable character.
No characters in Rob Zombie movies are ever likable, no. To be fair.
There's really not.
Also, yeah, McDowell usually has this bad era feeling about him. Like, He never feels like a nice guy. Like,
yeah, and even him, you know, trying to – the scenes with him and Michael when Michael's younger and he's trying to get through to Michael. But with Pleasance, I feel like he was just – you sympathized with Pleasance. You didn't sympathize at all with Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah.
And him trying to cash grab, which in all reality is what somebody probably would do, you know, write the book and get behind there. Whereas, you know, Donald Pleasance was more of a white knight who was just trying to stop evil. He wanted nothing more than to prevent this from happening to anybody else. McDowell wanted to cash in on it. There were some great elements of that first Halloween remake. I loved, you know, Tyler Mane and why can't I think of her name? Who played the lead? Who played
isn't it Cherry Moon Zombie?
No, who played the lead? Who played Laurie? I feel like I should know her name. What year did that come out?
Scout Taylor Compton.
That's right. And she was good at times. It blew my mind that they were able to bring Danielle Harris back to play a high school kid. Like she still looked young enough to play a high school kid. So there were some good, you know, fight sequences between those two. The gore, it's a Rob Zombie movie. You're always going to get really good gore. And for him to do the second one, which I think is where he really fell kind of hard, even though I loved the opening sequence where she's dreaming and the Moody Blues is playing, the Knights in White Satin, and Michael's terrorizing the hospital. I thought that was okay. But yeah, everything with Michael as a kid, I don't know. I didn't like it. I didn't need it. I didn't want it. Because in that first one, all you get is Michael, and they pull the mask off him when he's standing outside, and then it's 15 years later, Smith's Grove Sanitarium. Who taught him to drive a car? He was doing very well last night. Maybe somebody gave him lessons. But yeah, Rob Zombie, it's hard, man, especially when that original one was genre defining. It changed horror forever. And he just put his weird spin on it. He always has a good choice in music, though. I do, and you know what? I always watch his movies, no matter what. I'll watch it to see what it is. I just feel like The Devil's Rejects was kind of his best movie, and we'll see what happens with Three from Hell. I think we're supposed to be getting a trailer soon. It's supposed to be a trailer. Yeah, sometime. Oh,
he already showed it at his concerts, right?
He showed. I don't think that was the full trailer. I think that was like some clips and some other stuff. I actually got tickets. We're going to see him in August. We're going to see him in Marilyn Manson. And I told Shane and I have been joking. It's like the geriatric tour for those two guys because they're getting up there in age, man. Still out there doing it. But I've seen Zombie Live 4 or 5 times, and he puts on a hell of a stage show. His shows are always amazing. Wow. Yeah, his shows are always good. But yeah, Halloween and Halloween 2, those are tough ones. But I will say I like the second half of the first one. So I'll take it for what it's worth.
So do you have any other bad ones? You said you could keep going for Anna.
Yeah, I'll just name a few. We don't have to get into detail on any of them. Cabin Fever, Carrie. I don't know if you've ever seen the 98 remake of Carnival of Souls.
No.
Yeah, that just wasn't there. The Crazies wasn't bad. The Crazies wasn't a terrible one. Dark Water, again, that was from the time when they were trying to remake a lot of the Eastern stuff. Dark Water, The Eye, The Fog. The Fog was a really rough remake. Fright Night, that was a brutal remake.
I haven't seen that one yet, but I got it on my shelf.
House on Haunted Hill wasn't terrible. That was an okay remake.
I haven't seen that remake, but is it as fun as the original? Because the original is not scary.
No, the original was really gimmicky for the most part. You know, everything was a gimmick with the original one. It's I would say give it a go. It's not terrible. I Spit on Your Grave was a remake that did not work. Knock Knock. Knock Knock is almost a laughable remake of Death Game. Which, you know, you got some great Keanu. I'll always support Keanu. I've been saying that for years.
Since we're talking Keanu, just a short side note, I've seen John Wick 3 finally.
Yeah, what'd you think?
I really liked it. It's up there with the others. It's just like a great trilogy so far.
And so good.
Well, since we're a horror podcast, I wonder if it was a coincidence, but I think not because... who was it? I think Halle Berry says at one point to him, meet me in room 237.
Yeah, or no, 217.
217.
Yeah.
And that's
the Shining room.
Okay, 217 is the Shining room in the book.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's a coincidence or if that was on purpose.
I doubt it. That number is so synonymous with horror. Everybody knows that number. But that one was John Wick 3, that was good. I really like John Wick 3.
It's lots of fun, and everyone should see it. It's not a horror movie, even though it's got more gore than most horror movies these days.
Right. Yeah, I love that whole sequence with him and her in Egypt. Where were they? Casablanca? They were that whole gun sequence and them dogs. Oh, it was so good. Anyways, we could start talking about John Wick. The Last House on the Left was completely unnecessary. Let Me In is an interesting one because you get people who haven't seen the original or prefer the remake. Which, what was the remake? Let the Right One In?
Let the Right One In is the original.
Let the Right One In is the original. Let Me In is the remake. I always get those two confused. Which the original in that case, I feel like the remake was unnecessary. They have Lights Out listed, but I thought Lights Out was just a short film.
I think they take that as like, it's a remake of the short film he made. I wouldn't count that.
Right.
I would say it's an adaptation maybe or something, but yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Just like, you know, you had the Saw short film, you had the Evil Dead short film. I just wouldn't count those.
By the way, Chloe Grace Moretz really loves doing horror remakes, right?
Yeah, she does.
She was in
Carrie.
Amityville Horror, Carrie, the one you just said.
Yeah, Let Me In.
And Suspiria. That's 4 horror remakes she's been in.
She's the queen of horror remakes.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. But so far, I'm like 2 hours into Suspiria, and so far she's been in there for like 5 minutes. I'm not sure if she's coming back.
Yeah, she's not in it a lot. Suspiria. Yeah, okay. Suspiria was a good remake, but we'll wait till you finish watching it all the way, and then we'll talk about it. Yeah. So what else we got? We got Martyrs, which was a terrible, terrible remake.
And Inside is probably the same.
They made a remake of that as well. Yeah, just as bad. Just as bad. Let's see. My Bloody Valentine 3D wasn't terrible. Night of the Demons. Did you ever see the 2009 Night of the Demons with Shannon and Elizabeth?
I haven't seen the original yet, I think.
Oh, you got to watch the original, man. That's fun. Yes,
I know. I want to.
Yeah, that's a fun movie. We talked about The Night of the Living Dead's Nightmare on Elm Street, which wasn't... Go ahead.
I bought that movie yesterday at the flea market. I said I got it on DVD for $150, and I said I'm just going to buy it because I already got all the other Nightmare on Elm Street movies and Freddy vs. Jason. That's the only one missing in the Nightmare on Elm Street collection, so now I've got them all.
Got to have it. It was... The story wasn't bad. Is the thing. The story wasn't bad, but we've come to associate Fred Krueger with Robert Englund so closely that to take him out of that is it's going to be a huge uphill battle to make that movie work. And the story itself wasn't terrible. I liked it the way... Well, you know what? You haven't seen it, so I'm not going to tell you what they did differently than the first one. We didn't even mention the 70s version of Nosferatu. Nosferatu the Vampire?
Yeah, the German version by Werner Herzog.
Yeah, that's...
I've seen that.
Yeah, that's not a bad remake. The Omen was a rough one. This one is listed as 1963, so I don't know when the original was, but The Old Dark House, which I watched.
The original was the 30s.
Okay, yeah, so I watched. So which one was the 60s? That was the one I watched, though, the Karloff one, right?
No, Karloff is in the 30s.
Oh, okay. So that's the one I watched the other night. So I've never seen the remake of The Old Dark House. We've got Piranha 3D, which it knew what it was. It was kind of stupid and funny, but it was The Omen. That's a rough remake. Poltergeist was a terrible remake. Prom Night.
That sucked.
Yeah, Prom Night was rough. Even though I don't think this was a remake, I did watch it when they showed it on TV. I think it was last year. The Rocky Horror Picture Show. Let's do the time warp again.
There was more of a TV special.
Yeah.
Oh, and another good one, I'd say, is I'm not sure if you can count it a remake because Corman in the 60s did on like no budget in 3 days, he made The Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah.
Got then turned into a musical, and that musical got made into a movie. So I'm not sure if we should count that as a remake of the movie or if we should say, no, that's just... A new movie
was,
inspired.
It was an adaptation of the musical.
Yeah, and that musical was inspired by the movie. So it kind of, if it was, then that's probably the best remake.
Right.
Also that... of the worst movie, because I love Roger Corman, but that movie isn't good.
No. And the only reason people still even talk about it is because you had a young Jack Nicholson in it.
Yeah, and because it's got a new movie.
And the last couple, let's see, 13 Ghosts wasn't a terrible remake. I actually enjoyed the different ghosts in that one. The Uninvited was pretty bad. Village of the Damned wasn't terrible. And I think that's
about Carpenter, right? The Village of the Damned remake?
Yeah. Yeah, but I like the original one. There's something a little bit creepier about the kids in that original.
Yeah.
So that's all I had. And my last question that I wanted to see your thoughts. So we've got actually a big remake coming out in a couple weeks. We've got the Child's Play remake is hitting the big screen, coming out against Toy Story 4. So it's going to be a theater full of toys.
And they already do all the posters where they kill the Toy Story characters.
Those were so fun. Whoever did those, that was a great job. But it's okay.
Posters, I think.
Yeah. No, I think you're right that they are official, but whoever was the artist behind it, it was... let's see if we can find the... So my last question for you, what movie, if any, would you like to see remade? Is there anything at all that you would like to see remade?
There's probably lots. Like, I think with remake... Well, I'd always rather see a great new original. There's so many movies. I'd like to see a high-budget remake of Slashers. Just in general, if I have to pick a movie that's going to be remade, I would always pick something that has potential but right. isn't great, so that someone with lots of talent can make it great, like they did with like Carpenter did with the Thing from Another World.
Yeah,
like they tried with, well, no, that the Day the Earth Stood Still, that original is really good, but I mean like some forgotten obscure movie from the 60s.
So what about, or, I was thinking about it, what about Spider Baby? You think they could do a remake of Spider Baby?
I'm not sure, because I think that movie works best because of its limitations, because it is so cheaply made and creepy and has these actors. I'm not sure if we just got a newer version of that, it would be as good, unless they put something new into it. Then they probably could do something great. That's the thing. I can't think of a good remake, because I want someone to make something original out of the old concept that he right. found.
Yeah, that's fair,
like
man.
Like when we hear Tarantino, all his movies are remakes, but remakes of movies no one ever knows, and he makes something completely new into it.
Right. Even though what's he talking about doing? Star Trek?
He wants to do Star Trek.
Yeah, his first kind of not original property.
Yeah.
Okay, so we got a lot of remakes on there, some good, some bad, and the ugly. And we want to know what you think. Let us know or maybe a remake we missed that we completely forgot about, or are there any good ones? Let us know your favorite remake. I did see Baskin was listed as a remake, which Baskin was, that movie was so good. But I didn't even know there was a different version of Baskin. But yeah, let us know what remakes you enjoy, what ones you think are absolute trash, where they stomped all over one of your favorite movies, one of your favorite horror movies. But let us know what you think. And if you want to get into contact with us, all the social media platforms are the same, IHOH Podcast, or you can email us directly at IHOHpodcast@gmail.com. And if you would jump onto Apple Podcasts, leave a rate and review. That would be awesome of you to do. And for the International House of Horrors, I am Joe Merle.
I'm Josh.
And we'll be back next week with more things terrible, horrible, brutal, bloody, gory, and the macabre.